proof for the efficacy of the HPV vaccination.
If you're taking aspirin and you're going to have heart surgery, do you continue it or stop it?
A humane change in ovarian cancer treatment.
Recognizing and treating acute respiratory distress syndrome.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on February 26, 2016, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we start first with the one that speaks to my heart? That's in the Journal of Pediatrics, the efficacy of the HPV vaccine in preventing a precursor to cervical cancer in young women.
So Elizabeth, you said it's close to your heart. You want to tell a little bit more about that?
I'm an advocate for this vaccine. I think everybody ought to be getting it, including young boys. We'll talk more about that, I'm sure, as we talk about the study, because no matter what else it does, it's clear that it prevents cancer.
Well, since mid-2006, HPV vaccination has been recommended for females age 11 to 12 and through age 26 if they've not been vaccinated, and recently for males as well. What this study attempted to do was to look at the prevalence of HPV after introduction of the vaccination program here in the United States. So they looked at data pre-vaccine and after the vaccination was administered. And this was the four polyvalent vaccine aimed at the four most common HPV infections that are associated with cervical cancer. And what they determined was between the pre-vaccine and vaccine era that the prevalence declined 64%, specifically among females aged 14 to 19, and a 34% decrease among females aged 20 to 24 years. In fact, it was most effective in those that received it, no surprise. How effective? About 89% effective. So this is really good data that shows the prevalence is decreasing, and that's due to the vaccination.
The proof of the pudding, of course. Are we still looking at a 3-dose regimen of the vaccine?
Well, that's interesting because what the survey found is between the ages of 13 to 17 years of age, 57% of the women screened or girls screened actually received the vaccination, but that was just one dose, and only about 38% received all 3 doses. So this suggests that, in fact, some vaccination, even if they haven't received all 3 doses, may be beneficial.
Of course, that's no endorsement of reducing the number of doses someone gets.
Absolutely. And by the way, the new polyvalent vaccination will actually cover 9 rather than just 4 types of HPV infection.
So I guess our take-home message is for all those parents out there who've been sitting on the fence trying to decide whether they're going to elect this vaccination for their children, and that's boys as well as girls, we would say this is pretty powerful evidence that they ought to move forward.
Absolutely, Elizabeth. Even among the target age group now, only as many as 50% actually receive the vaccination. It's proven to be effective. I think it needs to be rolled out to all the ages that are recommended.
From here, why don't we turn to the New England Journal of Medicine? Something else I think is really good news, and I picked this study also. Don't you love, Rick, how I'm picking the studies that I picked first in our discussion this week? Anyway, this is a reduction in the interval for women who are undergoing treatment for ovarian cancer. And as I said, I think it's humane.
So let me frame this up, because ovarian cancer is the most lethal gynecologic cancer and responsible for about 14,000 deaths in the United States annually. And unfortunately, our chemotherapy has not been as effective as we'd like, either in prolonging survival or increasing survival. Now, several years ago, besides routine chemotherapy, which has side effects, we introduced immune therapy, a drug called bevacizumab, and that was shown to prolong progression-free survival. And that is, it lengthened the life of the individual about 3 or 4 months, but it didn't actually increase the cure rate. And currently, they're administered every 3 weeks. And the question is, could we get a better result if we gave the chemotherapy every week instead of every 3 weeks? So they examined almost 700 patients, most of whom were receiving the immune therapy, and randomized them to receive the chemotherapy either every week or every 3 weeks. And what they determined was giving it every week did not, in fact, improve survival. Women, on average, survived about 14 months after therapy was initiated, but the weekly therapy was associated with more side effects. higher incidence of anemia and higher neuropathy or nerve damage. So what this suggests is that weekly therapy isn't any more beneficial than therapy given every 3 weeks.
And the reason that I called it humane, of course, is because I like studies like this that examine, hey, if we intensify therapy, is there really any benefit associated with that? We know there are harms associated with it. And so if we can say, hey, only every 3 weeks instead of once a week, to me, that sounds like a great thing.
What I would have liked to have seen is that as we change therapy, we actually improve survival. And that's the disappointing part to me. To have a diagnosis and restart chemotherapy and to have a lifespan of only 14 months. And also because there's no good way to routinely screen for this.
Yeah, this is a tough nut to crack. Clearly something where we need to A, come up with screening and B, more effective therapy.
Agreed.
Since we're in NEJM, why don't we stay here? What about you're taking aspirin? And now you're going to have surgery. Should you discontinue it? A long time practice, once again, subject to scrutiny.
And Elizabeth, obviously this speaks to my heart as a cardiologist. When we refer patients for cardiac surgery and the patients are on aspirin, oftentimes we recommend they stop it because it's a blood thinner. And our concern is it will increase bleeding during the operation. Conversely, you wonder, well, gosh, will that put the bypass grafts at risk? Or could the person have a heart attack in the 2 or 3 days waiting for surgery? We've really not known exactly what to do. So I'm really pleased to announce the results of this study. And this was over 2,100 patients. It was actually a 2-by-2 study. One is to look at the effects of aspirin and then another anti-clotting drug. And that will be talked about in the future when we have those results. But the aspirin results are clearly available. 2,100 patients that were referred for bypass surgery in half the individuals. They gave them aspirin just prior to the surgery and obviously afterwards. The other half, they gave them placebo prior to the surgery and then started the aspirin after the surgery. When they looked at the primary outcome, did the individuals experience death, a clotting complication like a heart attack or a stroke or a pulmonary embolism within 30 days of surgery, there was no difference between the groups. About 1 in 5 individuals suffered one of these complications. One of the things it did reveal was that about 15% of individuals experienced a heart attack or some heart muscle damage as a result of the bypass surgery. So that's just a known complication of the bypass surgery.
How is someone supposed to factor that one into their decision making?
Well, there are clear patient population groups that we can say benefit survival-wise from having bypass operation. Those with severe involvement of all three blood vessels or the main blood vessel called the left main disease or people with heart failure and multivessel disease. But the vast majority of individuals, bypass surgery doesn't necessarily improve their survival. It just decreases their symptoms.
And for right now, you would say that if you've been on long-term aspirin, you don't necessarily need to discontinue it previous to surgery.
That's what this study would suggest.
Okay. Finally, then, let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. Something that appears to be increasing, especially with all these emerging viruses, and I cite MERS as an example, acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS. What about how should we treat that?
As you described, there are a lot of different things that can lead to this respiratory distress syndrome or ARDS. Ultimately, it's an acute inflammatory lung injury. And when the lung is injured, it increases the permeability of the blood vessels. Fluid leaks out. It causes difficulty with breathing, decrease in oxygen content. We have clear definitions of what constitutes acute respiratory distress syndrome or ARDS. And we have known ways that we can improve the outcome. Because when people develop ARDS, they get put on some type of ventilation. And we know that we can manipulate the ventilation to improve the outcome. Make sure the volume of the ventilation is not too high, or we get a little bit of pressure at the end, something called PEEP, or how we position the patient. Well, what these authors did was a very interesting study. They said, well, before you can treat it, you have to recognize it. If you take a survey of hundreds of intensive care units across 50 different countries and look at tens of thousands of patients, how often is ARDS recognized and how often is it appropriately treated? They looked at over 450 intensive care units that admitted over 29,000 patients in 50 different countries across 5 continents. About 10% of individuals fulfilled the ARDS criteria. But of those, as often as a half of the patients with mild to moderate ARDS or 25% of them with severe ARDS weren't even recognized by the physician. Then when we talk about applying therapy, it was commensurately not applied routinely to the patients with ARDS. It's important because their mortality is 35 to as much as 40 or 45%. We've got to do a better job of instructing individuals of how to make that diagnosis and how to apply appropriate therapy.
Very interesting. So tell me about the diagnosis then.
Diagnosis is based upon recognizing whether the person is hypoxemic or not, whether they have decreased oxygen in their blood, knowing whether they're requiring any type of ventilation. The x-ray also contributes to the diagnosis. Now you say, well, what about in poor countries that don't have all these things? We can actually measure the saturation from the finger. We don't have to draw blood gas. We can do a sonogram of the chest. We don't have to have an x-ray. And so there are alternative ways to make the diagnosis, even if the country is resource poor. Many of these patients were in developed countries, and the diagnosis wasn't made, and the therapy wasn't appropriately applied. Again, that's just changing ventilator settings. I have a lot of work to do in this particular area.
Yikes, a lot of awareness sounds like needs to be created here.
So which of these do you want to highlight on the blog, Elizabeth?
I'm going to do the HPV vaccination. No surprise to you, I know.
No surprise at all. I think if we can affect change in this particular area, I'll be pleased with what we've done.
Excellent. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.